Yeah. It's nice to see, first of all, because it was kind of tricky to know. I was talking to my friend Alison about this, and it was tricky to know exactly, number one, how to pitch this paper, and number two, how many people would actually turn up, you know, whether or not, and in a very Freudian way. I brought my mum with me from Newcastle. And, you know, I thought, well, if it's me and my mum, then, you know, that's enough, and Alison, it'll be fine. But it's nice to see there are a couple of old students here, some friends, and also some new faces. So that's really nice. As you'll know by now, obviously I'm Gareth, and firstly, before I get into the paper, I just want to say what a huge privilege and honour it is actually to be here at the Freud Museum. It feels both kind of surreal and affirming in that this is a place that I've visited since I did my master's degree actually in London at Goldsmiths in 2002, and in many respects to get me to this point, to the point where I'm going to, well, the point that I'm going to talk about, some of the points rather that I'm going to talk about this evening, points allied to queer theory, to Lacanian and Freudian psychoanalysis, and also the context connected to the study and the theorization of, and you can see there, the selfie, micro-celebrity and celebrity culture, pornography, sexuality, eroticism, particularly with a contextual focus on masculinities. What I'm trying to say there is that these issues have in some ways been energised and triggered since that time, really, by this museum in part. And I think it's very important to echo what Danny said there, that you know, this museum is one of those unique spaces that enables people like me, academics like me, to, number one, talk in a kind of academic way, but also to engage with and use a psychoanalytic, rather, lens to talk about contemporary culture, particularly in contemporary cultural issues, which I think is very important. Thanks go to Danny for the great introduction, and also to Lily and to Daniel and all of the team here for setting this up and for publicising it. Everybody's been incredibly kind and warm and patient and with good humour. Okay, the title of this paper is also, as Danny mentioned, the working title of my first academic monograph, which I'm currently working on, and all being well, should be due out in late 2018. And hopefully there'll be at least two journal articles allied to some of the issues that I'm going to also discuss this evening. I'm testing this out in some respects, okay? I have, and I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail in a second, but there are lots of kind of Freudian and Lacanian terms which we could use to talk about these kinds of contexts, the selfie, micro-celebrity, pornography, and masculinities, etc. But I kind of thought when I agreed with Lily to do this paper that I would challenge myself, and also hopefully kind of challenge you guys, to think a little bit more conceptually and a little bit more abstractly beyond the kind of obvious concepts, for instance, of narcissism, fetishism, voyeurism, that we see quite frequently actually in media and cultural studies and media and cultural theory around the discourse of the self when psychoanalysis is used to analyse that self through a kind of cultural text. I've produced a PowerPoint, as you can see here, but I want this PowerPoint to be a guide more than anything. This is not, you know, me teaching a bunch of undergraduate students, so I certainly don't want this to be instructive. And I'm not instructing or claiming that any of these ideas or concepts that I'm setting out to conceptualise are in any way kind of orthodox or objective or truthful. Okay, I'm coming from a very kind of conceptual place, so I hope, you know, you'll be able to follow that. Certainly, if you get lost, or, you know, I'm kind of drilling too deeply into all of those kind of Lacanian things, please feel free to stop, and hopefully at the end, my paper should last about 45 minutes, there will be scope and space for some discussion. Alright then. During the development of this research, I've moved, and I've just mentioned this, in and out of fairly obvious, I think, Freudian and Lacanian parameters. For instance, concepts such as narcissism, ego, ego ideal, voyeurism, fetishism, perversion, hysteria, and the gaze. All of these concepts, I feel, offer up a way to read the contemporary self-representational subject. And certainly, psychoanalysis seems to offer us a rich epistemological framework within which to interpret and to problematize the ways in which self-representation and indeed the selfie, one could argue the kind of textual result of what we understand as contemporary self-representation, the selfie to be read. As I've mentioned to you, there are lots of layers to my research, and certainly narcissism, the gaze, and several other conceptual approaches are being worked on. But for now, I thought that perhaps the most challenging, and perhaps for me the most complex aspect of my work could be discussed this evening. So, I thought it would be useful to begin with, just to kind of dive in with a guide and some clarity around the key theoretical concepts I've used to establish and to analyse the intersections between self-representations, particularly when we understand them as selfies. And I think increasingly, actually, selfies are becoming so kind of contingent in terms of what they actually are. Selfie is not particularly, or strictly speaking, just the kind of camera lens inverted and turned on the self and then posted to social media. Certainly from work that I'm doing with undergraduate students, you know, they're kind of quite refreshing in terms of how they understand the selfie. It might be a picture of food. It might be a picture of, you know, something that they've just bought in some respect. That kind of intimates and gestures in the direction, I think, of self-representation as well. So maybe just kind of loosen up, particularly when I'm talking about selfies, even though some of the selfies that I'm going to offer up as kind of visual support this evening are in themselves very kind of obviously selfies. But think beyond, and I like to think in that way quite frequently, think beyond perhaps what a selfie actually is, okay? To go back to what I've just kind of said, but to kind of not retract necessarily this reconceptualization of the selfie, but certainly to look at the kinds of visual examples that I'm interested in, and the visual examples that I'm going to kind of use to support and hopefully for broke some of these ideas. As you can see, some of these key contexts are kind of primarily connected to celebrity and discourses of what we might understand as pornography. With pornography as such a kind of contingent, and Danny and I were talking about this, such a kind of contingent shifting term. What is porn, for instance? What is pornographic? Some of you might also be familiar with terms such as pornification or pornographication. I'm thinking of the work of people like Fiona Atwood, people like Carissa Smith, for instance, who reconceptualize what pornography might be. So you'll see, I mean, these are kind of connected to indexes or indices that I would suggest are potentially pornographic. But disappointingly, what you're not going to see this evening is kind of, you know, hardcore porn in that respect. Okay, damn, so half the room leaves. These sorts of contexts here, therefore kind of attend to, and I think they connect to, the more detailed nuances of particularly what the contextual strands of my research are interested in. And certainly what might be termed, in many of these sorts of images, micro-celebrity, okay? This is primarily, in my presentation this evening, allied to the likes of male reality television stars, male sports stars, male models, okay? Particularly with a UK emphasis, and with a central focus on the critique of what might be understood in these sorts of images as phallic male bodies, bodies allied to a normative, dominant, hegemonic, homosocial, white heterosexual, and indeed, in some instances, heterosexist masculinity. These popular and recognisable practices also capture and amplify how the boundaries between public and private are implicated in and often challenged or changed, for instance, by social media. In turn, they also steer the sexually charged celebrity selfie away from processes of simply representing eroticism, sex, and or sexual explicitness on camera, for instance, in the way that a porn star might, okay? Towards, I think, a far more complex way of digitally networking it and digitally sharing it. The celebrity sex selfie, if we want to give it a kind of discourse or give it a name, in that respect, and or the sexually explicit images we increasingly see of celebrities on platforms such as, for example, and you'll be all familiar with this, Instagram, Tumblr and Snapchat, indicate that when the celebrity, for instance, self-captures their own sexual image, this becomes, and I quote the work here of Nancy Thuman, both a political and a cultural matter because of the range of associations that we make with it. Attending to that then, and in this paper, I'll argue that it's perhaps most obviously performed through the sexually inflected or explicit selfie, and certainly its ubiquitous nature online. Also, and to offer up a working definition and an interpretation of the selfie, I'm suggesting that they are primarily photographic objects, but also, as you can see here, these selfies are more or less kind of screen grabs, so they're connected also to moving images, all right? And they initiate within that kind of that framing or that visual rhetoric, the transmission of a human feeling in the form of a relationship. Now what that relationship is, we can talk about as we kind of develop the argument. One could argue that these selfies or self-representations are tied to a kind of index of reciprocity and non-reciprocity. You know, are these selfies meant for one person, or are they strategically meant through the discourse, for instance, of celebrity self-promotion? Are they meant for us to see? Are they meant to promote the self as a kind of strategic tool within, for instance, late capitalism? I'd like to explore that as the kind of paper goes on, but to conclude just the kind of introduction to things, and to build on what I've said there about reciprocity and non-reciprocity, we see here that these kinds of images, or selfies per se, may well also connect to a practice and a gesture that can send, and is often intended to send, different messages to different individuals, communities, and audiences. Indeed, I see the selfie, the celebrity, and pornographically inflected bodies contained within them as key features and discourses in late capitalism. These are the key features and discourses within the late capitalist framework that are produced, consumed, shared, and also disposed of from what we might suggest are a combination of neoliberal, consumer-led, and socially mediated societies. Without name-dropping too many theorists, you know, this kind of position, and when I was putting the paper together, the kind of books in front of me on my desk, I thought it might be handy just to kind of generate some names, really, as to kind of where I'm coming from. And these are not, strictly speaking, psychoanalytic names, you know. So names like, for instance, Guy Debord, Lee Hockenheim, Rosemary Hennessy, and Mark Fisher, Slavoj Žižek, for instance. My own focus, and this focus on what we might kind of superficially suggest here, are young heteronormative male bodies, and also ones that are often constructed and, for instance, appear on predominantly microblogs, porn sites, or social networks which are geared and aimed towards gay male consumption and arousal. Gay men consume. If you go onto Tumblr, for instance, there are lots of blogs which are geared towards gay male consumption in terms of these kinds of representations. That kind of thing then, as you can tell by now, forms my own specific context. But I'd also like to think that this bodies that stutter concept, which I'm going to kind of drill into as the paper goes on, is and should be in some ways transposable. In other words, it should go beyond just an analysis of the ways in which, for example, heterosexual and white male bodies are often framed for queer and or gay male consumption. In other words, I hope, and this is potentially where I need your kind of criticism and help as an audience, you know, that this concept, the bodies that stutter concept, might eventually be able, and this is what I'm working towards in the monograph, might well eventually be able to be applied to a range of bodies, a range of representations, acts, gestures, for instance. Danny and I had a very interesting conversation before the talk this evening about trans bodies, and for instance how trans bodies might, within this kind of theoretical and conceptual framework, be analysed, reconceptualised, positioned, for instance. All right, let's get into the kind of the interesting bit, the psychoanalytic and the theoretical. All right then, my theoretical and psychoanalytic starting point for this approach has to start somewhere. You can't just invent a term, okay? My approach for this bodies that stutter concept and the issues that I've alluded to in the abstract of this paper are first and foremostly informed and influenced by the work of Tim Dean. Tim Dean's work, Beyond Sexuality, which was published in 2000. Dean, which I'm sure many of you will be familiar with, is a psychoanalytic scholar and also a queer theorist who effectively sets out to, and he's very unapologetic about this, to queer the work of Jacques Lacan, and certainly through that kind of queering, or he actually refers to it as a querying of Lacan, he boldly asserts that since the 70s, Lacanian, but also Freudian modes of thought, have become so pervasive and persuasive in cultural studies and cultural theory that we all too easily assume that, for example, desire and sexuality are products of, and I quote, rhetoric, discourse, culture, history, social relations. This powerful version of desire and sexuality as socially and culturally rhetorical has become, Dean argues, so ubiquitous that it has in effect kind of naturalized itself into contemporary cultural theory. Dean suggests that a re-engagement with the unconscious via Freud and via Lacan and via psychoanalysis may be where, for example, a new method or indeed a new discipline is located. He also points out that the very action of asking how to move beyond rhetorical versions of sexuality and desire forms a kind of productive ambiguity or a productive anxiety, in that the frameworks, the methodologies, and the academic literature for such a mode of inquiry are in themselves rhetorical. Therefore, something of my job this evening, I think, may be in considering how we use Lacan and psychoanalysis more generally, aspects of Freud as well, to read some of these paradigms, namely self-representation, celebrity, micro-celebrity, pornography, and in what ways it's in a psychoanalytic line of inquiry and how a psychoanalytic line of inquiry, when it's problematized or when it's made to be problematic again, how that might make possible intersectional visual politics, which, in this instance, question the kind of the orthodoxy of conventionally heterosexual or gay masculinity. I also think it's important here that psychoanalysis for me, methodologically certainly, and it wasn't easy, but within my PhD thesis and certainly moving towards the publication of this monograph, psychoanalysis to me is the kind of central methodology within which I've been able to exist within cultural theory, but also to kind of move through it and beyond it. It's allowed me, I think, to do more with the discourse of the analysis of, for instance, these selfies than, I don't know, other paradigms or other approaches may well do. This kind of approach then is fundamental to how my own research has been formed, and it's useful because Dean and Lacan initiate and indeed complicate established discursive and rhetorical meanings of desire and gender. In their efforts to do so then, they attempt to define or redefine, yet never offer up a kind of clearly, you know, foreclosed definition, and consider particularly how the key concept of jouissance, which I'll come to in a while, catalyzes and underpins desire, and how this goes in some ways towards my own original concept of bodies that stutter. Alongside of that, how the trajectories aligned to that concept of bodies that stutter are intensified, particularly here, when representational frameworks of celebrity, pornography, and self-representational media overlap. I'm very interested in the overlaps. This kind of idea, and I'm not one for kind of coining or making up, you know, sexy terms within cultural studies, but certainly the overlaps between celebrity, pornography, and self-representation for me seem to form not necessarily a specific rhetoric or discourse of self-representation, but certainly there's something here which potentially a decade ago was not recognisable to us. But now, increasingly, I went for a Starbucks on my way down here this morning. There was a copy of The Sun on the counter. And on the front of The Sun, there's this kind of big, you know, strap line which says, celebrity Big Brother housemates in sex tape scandal. And we've got two housemates, straight male housemates, and their images are plastered all over tabloid media. That to me kind of indicates something, you know, that there's something going on here representationally, but also in terms of late capitalist bodies or neoliberal bodies, who are very willing actually, celebrity or not, to represent themselves in far more sexually provocative and sexually precarious ways through, for instance, technology than previously maybe they have done before. I think that before we get into my discussion of jouissance and how that might be useful to this kind of, this analysis of images like this, it might be necessary to account for the ways in which particularly Jacques Lacan's concepts of real, symbolic and imaginary are assembled in relation to subjectivity, selfhood, representation and desire, and how they originate in his work. As I said, I didn't want to kind of transform this into a lecture. Okay, so again, many of you will be familiar with these concepts, but I thought, you know, it wouldn't do us wrong if we just kind of, you know, went over them again to kind of give a sense of where I'm coming from. The real, symbolic and imaginary functions primarily as a triad or a series of reciprocal and cyclical registers in which the unconscious's alignment to both language and desire overlap. This association has been usefully outlined by, for instance, someone like Slavoj Žižek, and his initial understanding of all three of the registers in terms of human relations and relationships, both with one another and also with the material world around them. Zizek observes, and I thought Zizek was a useful kind of conduit to talk about these three registers through. That firstly, well not firstly, but you know, in his analysis of them, or his definition of them, there is the imaginary other. Other people like me, and with whom I am engaged in mirror-like relations of competition. The imaginary is allied, as many of you will know, to the kind of birth of the ego, which during Lacan's mirror stage, the child simultaneously identifies with an image of itself, as a fully kind of synchronized and unified reflection, but in doing so is lured into what we might call a trap, in that every reflection, literal or conceptual, is potentially always a refraction of the self. Quite like that analogy, that a reflection is always a refraction. You never fully see yourself. I'm actually paraphrasing Lacan there, but, you know, you never fully see yourself seeing yourself. Or I never fully see myself seeing myself. That's a kind of, you know, it's a tongue twister. But when you kind of begin to conceptualize it, it's a fairly interesting place to start when we talk about self-representation. On that, I hope you might be thinking, as I am, that this opens up already when we look at the imaginary, an incredibly kind of interesting theoretical landscape when it's aligned to self-representation and the selfie as a cultural text. Here we see the imaginary is always a fiction or something that covers up what we might call a lack, a gap, or a kind of partial view of desire. Alongside of that, there is the symbolic. Symbolic, I understand, is a kind of bigger other. Yeah, the imaginary is an other with a small o, the symbolic an other with a big o. This might be the political, the representational, the kind of ideological substance of our social existence. The symbolic effectively kind of carves the world up into language, but in doing so must always leave something out. It could also be thought of as the impersonal set of rules that coordinate our coexistence beyond our kind of agency, beyond our control. It's also the symbolic register's stress on language that positions it as something unconscious, yet also riven and underpinned by power and regulation. The symbolic then might be understood as an order or a register that we're all born into, and it shapes our subjectivities and desires through discourses and processes which are beyond our own agency, beyond our own control. Zizek also discusses the real. The real is the kind of impossible thing, the inhuman partner, or more specifically the other with whom no symmetrical dialogue mediated by the symbolic order is possible. I quote Zizek there. I also like the kind of the discourse of the real, and I was looking through and trying to come up with, you know, a decent quote to use, and I came across something by Jacques-Alain Miller and his take on the real, in which he states that, and I quote again, "The real is the residue of all articulation, the foreclosed element, which may be approached but never grasped, the umbilical cord of the symbolic. The real is the thing that is left out after the symbolic cuts up the world, an excess that resists both imaginary and symbolic representation. It is that which cannot be known via language or materiality." So using these kind of contingent foundations and the fault lines, if you will, that exist between real, symbolic and imaginary, we might also suggest that the kinds of desires that circulate around self-representations and selfies, particularly ones that are recognisable in some way as celebrities or micro-celebrities, and when they're indexed or informed by sexualised, eroticised or deep pornographic imagery, they seduce us into somehow seeing the celebrity body as an imaginary other. And the imaginary here acts as a very potent, a very strong way of repetitively enhancing and affirming an imaginary rhetoric of imaginary desire in language. However, and I would argue here, to engage and to be engaged at the level of language is to also make strange the body and desire. Rather, the seduction of the imaginary and the inevitable constraints that the symbolic has over it converge to displace the body and depersonalize the subject through language. And in many ways, this begins to form the foundation of my own concept of a body that stutters. At the same time, language has the effect of making the body appear somehow familiar and personal. For instance, the very terms in language, celebrity, selfie, porn, locate the imaginary other through modes of celebrity, pornographic and self-representation that are identifiably organised and regulated through late capitalist systems of imaginary agency, consumption, control and the individualised demands of the individualised demands and desires of the user, the subscriber, the member, for example, of a specific social networking site. Interestingly, when these terms are considered through the symbolic and the underlying power of the symbolic, and again I quote Zizek here, we see a set of rules that I follow and meanings that haunt me. And also we see that this bigger symbolic other, which is always perhaps impersonal, invisible, and or potentially hegemonic, this other may have the capacity and the power, for want of a better word, to encourage me as the user, the subscriber, the member of the social networking site, to misrecognise and doubt what celebrity is, what porn is, what selfie is. This might kind of lead us towards a different way of reconceptualising these representational objects in language. Accounting for these tensions then, between the symbolic to imaginary to real relation, we may also begin to see some of the fundamental ways in which bodies that stutter may begin to form, number one, through the real symbolic and imaginary, but also through Jacques Lacan's theory of jouissance. We also see that desire can only be manifested as desire through complex and precarious interrelations which always falter. Yet when these abstract exchanges are turned into signifying form, to quote Lacan, the signifying form here might be the selfie, we also see, and in this instance, that these selfies have the potential to begin to form a language of signification that unconsciously constructs a form of desire that might seem superficial, fickle, and facile, but one that also utters and ultimately stutters something associated with an individual's desire, their body, and where that body kind of sits or where it's located in relation to capitalism, and particularly also sexual politics in the second decade of the 21st century. To drill into this then a bit more, I think it might now be useful to briefly summarise and talk about jouissance and how this is then going to feed into the bedrock to my body's that stutter concept. So this term jouissance, it deliberately resists, subverts and kind of defies, if you will, definition. It does not translate into one English term, and as a result, from the French, it's balanced almost on the kind of linguistic threshold of signification and meaning. For example, in French, the very term jouissance might be defined or spelled out as the subject's use and enjoyment of all of the advantages of a specific object of privilege or pleasure. It may also be understood as an orgasmic form of pleasure that is fleeting, but one that doesn't last, a sort of, dissatisfactory satisfaction. It also has ideological, political, and subjective interpretations. And in this way, jouissance becomes difficult and always unruly. It's often discussed in psychoanalysis through the signification of the phallus and phallic jouissance. But it's also here that it begins to kind of resist definition again, or indeed representation. And the subsequent ways in which it's theorised call into question the critical nature of what jouissance might be, particularly in relation to desire, but also in relation to pain and also anxiety. In this way, jouissance is relevant to the development of the concept of bodies that stutter, because both are reliant upon, yet remain difficult to translate and interpret within the symbolic field. As I kind of think through and I develop this a bit more, I think about how both jouissance and bodies that stutter are also akin to Lacan's real register. And how on the one hand they resonate and are absorbed into imaginary and symbolic forms of representation and language, yet on the other, and like the real, they cannot be reached, they can't be attained or satisfied. This approach, to go back to Tim Dean's work, is further endorsed by Dean in relation to how he actually positions and identifies jouissance through a simultaneously psychoanalytic and also queer framework. He observes that to grasp jouissance, one must firstly kind of understand that, and I quote, it's the barriers or limits to jouissance that permit the full spectrum of desire. And that in terms of a subject or a body that we see through discourses of self-representation, it is this barrier and the not unlimited access to jouissance that permits desire to actually flourish. It seems that to begin to articulate something, indeed anything, of jouissance, we must connect to the symbolic and the ways in which language always instills a limit to the subject jouissance's pleasure and also allows us somehow to access and gain, albeit a temporary, pleasure from it. It may also be worthwhile to note here that in terms of its challenging application, jouissance may map out some new intersections in relation to how we kind of see and articulate and indeed critique celebrity identity and pornographic representation. A lot like jouissance, I see celebrity and pornography and their convergence in these kinds of selfies. You know, this is a British reality TV star called Dan Osborne. Endlessly posts selfies and uses them as a central kind of capitalist tool in terms of his celebrity. You know, his celebrity is, as hundreds, thousands of celebrities are now, based on that kind of thing. You know, his identity, his body, his masculinity, his sex appeal, all of that is connected to these very strategically positioned selfies on social media, but also more formally through his kind of discourse as a television star, per se. You know, if you want to identify him as something, it's probably a reality TV star, per se. I think here, this kind of thing, the Dan Osborne example, if I just go back there, indicates to me that a lot like jouissance, celebrity and pornography, when they kind of converge in this way, and this is not strictly speaking pornographic, it's connected to eroticism, but there's a kind of pornographic intent built into the image. I see these kinds of images as transient, as non-fulfilling, enigmatic, fickle, subjective, self-conscious, and always other. Other in the symbolic sense. Of course in the imaginary sense as well, but other in the symbolic sense. Here, the pleasure and the desire of the subject is always triggered by this other. And whether, to kind of make this a bit more clear, whether this is an imaginary other, a real non-relation, or indeed a symbolic other, it becomes quite apparent that celebrity self-representations that are constructed and mediated, and in some ways informed by pornographically indexed or pornographically kind of textured rhetorics of desire as jouissance, and they become incredibly important. I think if we link this to social, cultural and political conditions allied to, again, late capitalism, capitalist realism, particularly in the work of Mark Fisher, and also the discourses of self-promotion and entrepreneurialism that are amplified and extended through celebrity, micro-celebrity, and indeed the amateur and self-produced pornography that we see the selfie has really had the capacity to proliferate and to promote and also to capture. The imaginary illusion that jouissance is manageable and containable becomes a kind of myth, yet it also attempts to sustain an illusion to indicate to us that subjects like Dan Osborne kind of speak desire, but that speaking is always riven by the symbolic and the real factors which begin to point towards this idea that jouissance and bodies stutter. In this way, jouissance and stuttering undercuts the construction of a kind of heteronormative, white, muscular, charismatic self, and this kind of capitalist illusion that in the 21st century, we're at the centre of our own discourse, we're kind of self-led. Through, however, discourses like celebrity culture and also pornography, we also see that we're somehow, in the next breath, in control, or can also customise, attain, promote, sustain our desires. Now that we've got some psychoanalytic concepts, and again, I was thinking, I began to do a diagram with kind of Butler and Dean and myself, and it was too formalising, so I've put these kind of, it's like blockbusters. So any of you used to watch the game show Blockbusters, it kind of looks like that. These things will move around, okay? They're not there formally, so that's just a kind of diagram to give a sense of where I am with the key concepts that I'm going to talk in this part of the paper. Now that we have some psychoanalytic concepts to hand, I'd like to begin now to align them to the relevance of my own concept of bodies that stutter. And once again, to kind of start this part of the paper, I think it's essential to account for how I actually began to conceptualise this idea of bodies that stutter, particularly using the work of Tim Dean, but also using the work of Judith Butler. In addition, it might also help to talk about the ways in which I reconceptualised the process of stuttering as a speech act, and how this might feed into a critical analysis of, as we know by now, celebrity pornography and self-representation. As I mentioned earlier, Dean's book from 2000, Beyond Sexuality, sets out to queer the psychoanalytic work of predominantly Lacan, but also in a way Freud. And at its core, there's also a strong critique, some cultural theorists would argue a kind of vehement critique in some ways, of Judith Butler's very well-known 1993 book, Bodies That Matter, on the discursive limits of sex. Dean effectively states in Beyond Sexuality that Butler has misread Freud and circumvented Lacan through her concept of bodies that matter. These bodies that matter are concerned with the materiality of the body and its surroundings. Butler suggests that, and I'm paraphrasing, bodies tend to indicate both a world beyond themselves and a movement beyond their own boundaries, a movement of boundary itself, which is quite central to what bodies are. Butler also insists that there is such a thing as the materiality of the body, and in her renowned theory of performativity, she theorises that this materiality has a palpable effect on the performance of gender through processes allied to regulation, to repetition, to subversion. We might then situate a key tension here as one that suggests that a body that matters, which is riven by materiality and the boundaries of language, image, power and discourse, is not merely implicated in a complicated tension between these boundaries of language, image, power and discourse as the psychic and the material, but that bodies that matter are that tension. For now, and for the purpose of the argument, these bodies that matter are in some ways configured through the regulatory ontology, here we are again, of an imaginary social body. A one in which the subject is coaxed into seeing an imaginary desire that momentarily functions to either visually, emotionally, or sexually satisfy, trigger, or fulfil that desire. We see this in the kinds of images that converge across the imaginary frameworks of desire that are fueled by and through celebrity and pornography. This kind of thing. This mattering body might also be one that is locked into a performative and repetitious materiality by the signification of what we might say is a bodily ego, or as Tim Dean's critique claims, a one simultaneously restrained by Lacan's imaginary and symbolic registers. For instance, it's clear that the sexually charged celebrity selfie, as a representational trope, indicates to us that here is an egotistical body that matters. It attempts, however, to matter, but in that attempt, it also fails to express fully desire, and more so, desire as jouissance. The thrill, for instance, the visual thrill, of seeing the imaginary other as a, you know, we have here a reality TV star, a movie star, another reality TV star slash model, seeing them in that way through the discourse of celebrity and recognising them as such, but alongside of that, also seeing them as a somehow sexually or erotically and ultimately pornographically inflected object of desire, excites and arouses, but it can only do so through the symbolic limitation of how this excitement and arousal is formed. The repetitive and regulatory spaces, for instance, of social media, that merge the discourses of public and private life, and also the thresholds of public and private identity, I would argue are key here, and they are, I would also argue primarily, symbolic spaces. Perhaps this is one of the tensions on which celebrity culture and indeed psychoanalysis are both built. For example, we all have a fascination with the celebrity on stage, on set, on screen. But potentially we also have more of a fascination with them off or behind the set, behind the scenes, behind the screen. So that in images like this, we see them behind the scenes as imaginary others tethered to the symbolic and functioning through ideological rules allied to the use of that reversible lens on the smartphone. For instance, we also see a recurrent performative and or ideological space. This list goes on, but just to give you some kind of visual clues as to what that space might be. The setting of the hotel room, the bathroom, the gym changing room, the shower cubicle, and indeed the social media site itself that they either upload the content to or somehow, you know, the content is leaked to through their failure to, for example, encrypt their iCloud. How that is hacked, leaked, prolifically shared onto and across social media indicates that there's quite an exciting symbolic space here which stutters somehow at a higher level than the body itself. In images like this, we see a symbolic subject, in this case a heterosexual celebrity object or commodity of desire, stutter because the subject fails to fully control, attain, and express desire through representation, and more so self-representation. I thought about the kind of conceptual ways in which a mattering and a stuttering body might also be layered over each other here, and also as a way to begin to unravel and falter. And in so doing, as I suggested at the beginning of my paper, I wanted this evening to look beyond the preservation of psychoanalytic concepts, for instance, such as narcissism and voyeurism, which have been instilled through an imaginary other, towards the possibilities of how bodies that matter might also give way to bodies that stutter. Bodies that are, on the one hand, torn, uncertain, and impatient, and on the other, urgent, stimulated, and desirable, unwittingly and negligently, I would argue, limiting and simultaneously amplifying jouissance to imaginary othering through symbolic and also real processes. Through this obstruction, the imaginary body that matters might well have become a key steer in late capitalism, as the body that always seems to be kind of self-led, yeah, self-represented, self-assured, and there to be voyeuristically looked at, the perfect body, in other words. But isn't it also the case that this is the body that's always vulnerable to a symbolic disembodiment that stutters? This stuttering involves processes of bodily and egotistical representation that falter, stammer, and hesitate to express the nature of jouissance. Perhaps it's also the case that bodies that stutter attempt to express a powerful jouissance through a strategic visual language or landscape of the selfie as a kind of key, I would argue, representational tool within capitalist and consumer-led societies, whereby a mode of imaginary desire is presented in an attempt to overcome the limitations of the symbolic other, the symbolic self, and indeed the symbolic self that stutters, as an imaginary yet ultimately futile way to try and master their own unconscious desires, which are allied to, and I mean I'm just going to read out a kind of list here, you know, self-reflection, self-definition, self-objectification, self-control, self-worth, self-help, self-denial, self-motivation, self-commodification, self-surveillance, self-self-self. The list goes on. That prefix being incredibly important in late capitalist neoliberal society, the kind of self-led discourse of the self. Looking back again then, and re-encountering Tim Dean's intervention, what does Tim Dean do with Judith Butler's bodies that matter? He transforms them in Beyond Sexuality into his own bodies that mutter, okay? He suggests that there's an implicit failure in Butler to recognise that desire as jouissance is limitless because it cannot be rationalised and totalised, and therefore it can never be clearly defined through an ego or the materiality of a body that matters. What is central, I think, to Dean's critique of Butler is hinged on the restrictive ways in which we, as desiring subjects, misconstrue and in many ways misrepresent desire in terms of an identifiable, personalised bodily other as opposed to a symbolic other. For instance, Butler sees desire in terms of a bodily materiality that she accounts for as both prior to signification as well as an effect of signification. In turn, she also suggests that there is a paradox associated with this body and that it is bound to, and I quote, the insolubility of materiality and signification, whilst also retaining materiality as its constitutive condition. Here the body is one that is aware of its mattering and its materiality, but Dean would argue kind of unaware of its muttering potentiality to mutter desire. In other words, the mattering body is one that accounts for material subjects of the signifier and not subjects of desire. That's from Dean. Here, the mattering body fails to recognise a desire beyond the constraints of the ego and the materiality of that ego. A key point, I think, to contemplate here is that Dean also bases his critique on what he sees as Butler's interpretation of a psychoanalytic concept of the ego as primarily a bodily ego, one that is aligned to conscious, anatomical, and biological sexual identity and difference. And as a result, he suggests that she's neglected the ways in which, I quote, egos occlude rather than manifest desire. These are Dean's muttering bodies, therefore, and they're the ones that, to quote Dean, speak almost inaudibly, unintelligibly. to obliquely indicate desire in the form of a failure in the imaginary and the symbolic discourse. Dean aligns the muttering body to a critique of Butler's work to suggest that her intervention produces bodies, again I quote, bearing egos but devoid of subjective desire. Here, she responds subsumed rather than enabled by the ego and, again I quote, the subjective desire emerges not when an identification is made, but when an identification fails to be made. In light of these conditions, and rather than veering towards one or the other, I'd like to intervene and to kind of reconcile or suggest that these bodies have both the material and the unconscious ability to matter and to mutter simultaneously. Through this interlinked process of mattering in the imaginary and muttering in the real, I argue that bodies begin to stutter also in the symbolic, or more so they're formed around modes of what I've termed symbolic stuttering. This might also work towards carving out new landscapes. Social media might be one of the kind of key spaces for this, for bodies that matter, mutter, and stutter at one and the same time, really. Building on both Butler and Dean, this new construction and or configuration of bodies that stutter, or potentially bodies that matter, mutter, stutter, may form a contingent foundation that we might also term symbolic stuttering. This might assist also in how to read desire and locate the body and the subjective jouissance between bodies that matter and mutter as a body that stutters. Whilst muttering is struggling to be heard, the stuttering I suggest here is not necessarily struggling. It's repetitively activating desire through the process of stuttering. Here the stuttering body produces a symbolic form of jouissance that will also stutter because it's torn between a body that matters and a body that mutters. In this case, the subject of the symbolic is the stutterer, a subject who's both alert and naive to the constraints and the limits of imaginary and also real modes of jouissance. The body that stutters is located between the mattering and muttering self, and the stuttering that's provoked in this space, that is between mattering and muttering, is done so hesitantly, indeterminately, and repetitively, like the process of stuttering in language. In this setting, stuttering is always realised retroactively, through a kind of gap, an excess, a slippage, between mattering and between muttering. It might also be worth mentioning here that the work that uses psychoanalysis to consider how and why the stutter is a feature of speech that disrupts the position of speaking itself has also been quite useful in my research. For instance, Juan David Nacio's work suggests that stuttering is aligned to the idea that, and I quote, when speech fails, jouissance occurs. That is, when desire or sexual pleasure and desire manifest themselves, the speech and the position of the speaking subject falters and fails to express desire clearly and coherently. There's some interesting work around that, particularly in relation to the lack of, for instance, coherent or kind of clear sound in porn movies. Yeah, you get the bad acting, but within the sex scene, you get groans, you get moans, you get the orgasm, for instance. Language fails the subject, yeah, or profanities. Yeah, it's that kind of idea that, for instance, the subject, when they are aroused, be it sexually or socially, or in some ways kind of clinging to a jouissance, fails to clearly articulate themselves. In this way, it's when speech goes astray and language is frustrated that stuttering gestures towards a way of speaking jouissance. In this way, stuttering is also a way of expressing jouissance that might well signify creativity, ambiguity, in verbal and non-verbal ways. As a result, it's through the body that stutters that the juxtapositions between speech as a verbal or textual manifestation of desire and jouissance as a non-verbal and signifying trace of desire meet. The interplay between jouissance and symbolic stuttering may also be close to a way of stuttering which was identified by the French theorist Gilles Deleuze in his essay He Stuttered, which was first published in English in 1994. It's a kind of little-known essay, but within it, Deleuze states that stuttering forms the place in which the symbolic other meets jouissance, and as a result, and I quote, puts language in a state of perpetual disequilibrium. Here he claims that when stuttering no longer affects pre-existing words, but rather itself ushers in the words that it affects, it presents us with an effective and intensive language. This is embedded and expressed through the jouissance and the body's that stutter and the symbolic, as opposed to, and I quote Deleuze again, an affectation of the one who speaks, rooted in, I would argue, the imaginary. This also links the stuttering subject to both the symbolic and the real, and their capacity and potential to express desire in ways that jar and shake up the ego and its imaginary facade. Certainly, if we begin to locate the idea of stuttering through the symbolic, we also see that, a lot like speech, desire requires a form of writing or representation to occur. In light of stuttering, bodies that stutter form a conceptual way for the speech act, or the process of speaking one's desire, to stammer, to slip, to slide, and to run together with the representation, indeed the writing of that desire. Here, the imaginary and the narcissistic divide between the subject and the other once again potentially fails, because these coherent identities cut across one another as incoherent identifications. Bruce Fink alludes to this notion of non-speech as jouissance and speech as non-jouissance through a focus on Lacan's search for, and I quote Fink, a signifier of the subject that could be found in statements, that is, in what is said. Fink examines Lacan's use of Roman Jakobson's theory of shifters from the 50s, from 1957, and more specifically the complex ways in which Jakobson formulates how, and I quote, personal pronouns in language such as I, you, he, etc., cannot be defined as such without reference to the messages in which they appear. Here, the patterns of speech and the exchange of words are dependent on how I, designating the message sender, and you, the message receiver or addressee, create a reciprocity or shift between what the message means and how it's interpreted. This shifting meaning also goes some way to initially define the message sender through the imaginary ego, in that the personal pronoun I designates the person who identifies his or herself with a specific ideal image. For example, we see through the selfie an attempt by the subject to speak the desires of their imaginary ego. Yet it's also through this attempt at speaking, and thus representing, selfies are there to be looked at, they are there often to be shared on social media for other people to absorb. That desire, I would argue, once again, begins to symbolically stutter towards jouissance. Craig Dworkin also observes that the disfluency of stuttering has, and I quote, such symbolic force that we tend to forget the extent to which a range of corporeal opacities are in fact a perfectly normal part of speech production. In this way, the stutter is an implicit component of speech production and coordination. This is echoed in the ways that jouissance itself stutters. It requires the loss of the other and the contingency of speech production to account for its pleasure as jouissance of the symbolic other. More specifically, Fink also suggests that the French word nay, literally not, and the English word but, interrupt the certainty of speech. They kind of demonstrate that interruption. And in so doing, introduce a conflict which is played out between a conscious or ego discourse and another agency. That which takes advantage of the possibility offered by, in this instance, English and French grammar, to manifest itself. Here the French nay and the English but are allied to the disruptive and the repetitive patterns of stuttering as jouissance. We see in much the same way that nay and but expose the precarious nature of speech and the enunciating imaginary subject, that the symbolically stuttering subject of jouissance introduces, in terms of, and I quote, a certain hesitation, ambiguity, or uncertainty into the utterance in which it appears, as if to suggest that the speaker is denying the thing he or she is asserting. This tension between the denial and assertion of desire locates the stuttering subject as one that refutes and slips through clear and articulate speech and representational patterns. If we think about this then in relation to something like the absence of a reciprocal, direct, face-to-face conversational dialogue in celebrity and pornographic representation in media, and look at how both celebrity and pornography are often formed and or constructed on the basis of a non-reciprocal desire. In other words, if I watch pornography, my desire is never fulfilled. It's never returned. It's never personable or tangible. It's always a construction. It's always a text. That's the key. We see that the allure, the success, and the desirability, for instance, and I'm back to kind of Dan Osborne there, and other images of these kinds of reality TV stars, And again, these are just scratching the surface. These are my examples. You could use any other number of examples. But images like this, which are the result of what happens when celebrity self-representation and sexualized discourses of the body converge, that through the self-conscious construction of desire, it is jouissance that is continually attempting to find a voice in a body that stutters. These kinds of selfies then might point towards what someone like Bruce Fink terms as a sort of no-saying, a saying no. That always reflects how nay and but in language gesture towards an always ambivalent speaker who says yes and no at the same time through a series of symbolic stutters. Online, and more so in digital and network media, this stuttering involves a combination of imaginary, real and symbolic processes of association between the signifiers within an image, the user and the viewer, the impersonality of representation itself as the locale of where desire is signified, and also this kind of via the inevitable quality of an image's transposability or transportability, its transience online. In the sexually charged selfie, and more so in the ones the subject comes to recognise or associate with celebrity identity, the subject can only express themselves through a series of identifications that rely upon symbolic modes of stuttering. Here, the ego and the associations that it has with an imaginary other fail to articulate desire, and in so doing, shift the potentiality of how jouissance can be realised to the symbolic. So what we might term symbolic stuttering, in the previous slide, indicates that the subject may be prior to speech, prior to the imaginary, yet ushered in by the pre-symbolic formation of the real. It's also in selfies that attempt to instill and represent the material dimensions of the body that matters via the amplification of sexual desire that the signifier and the user's bodies again begin to stutter. However, we also know that many social networks promote and espouse the line that there's such a thing as an identity, there's such a thing as a personality or a subject or user that is an identifiably desirable, sexy, white, muscular, affluent, charismatic celebrity with kind of subjective and or common desires. Yet they also produce and facilitate a cultural space where, in this instance, the men who do not conform or recognise themselves in terms of this body, personality, identity or object choice can indeed pursue sexual pleasure, sexual arousal, gratification impersonally. For example, there are a range of symbolic parameters that suggest that images like these are primarily there to arouse and to appeal to gay male consumers, and that there are a set of signifiers and discourses that frame, for instance, a typically desirable straight male body for gay male consumption and objectification. In late capitalism, this might also be seen through any number of signifiers, settings and scenarios that emphasise the tensions between gay pornography and the kind of erotic and sexually explicit indexes which are often captured in celebrity selfies. These guys are contestants in The X Factor, and these are selfies taken in the dressing room prior to a performance. We see a repetitive kind of index of representation here. And again, I'm repeating something of what I said earlier in the paper, but here we are again back in the same kind of place, returning to the same place. The smartphone, tattoos, tracksuit bottoms, six-packs, often kind of free weights, protein shakes, the bathroom mirror, the bathroom itself, the gym, that kind of thing. We also see this in a whole range of other very, very kind of normative straight masculine representations on social media, which are framed and informed by this kind of thing. The lad's holiday, the drunken night out, the toilet cubicle, the prank, the bed, the shower. It's endless, the list goes on. Accounting for this then and for bodies that stutter to stutter, we might now suggest that there needs to be somehow a particular set of tensions in place, particularly around these kinds of representations. And at this stage of the paper, it might be useful to begin to kind of sum up the dimensions of stuttering and the nuances of bodies that stutter, and also symbolic stuttering, in some concluding, but yet no means conclusive points. There are other selfies there. These points are not intended to be read or positioned as a manifesto of bodies that stutter or bodies that are allied to celebrity self-representation or pornography, and by no means are they kind of installing or claiming an orthodoxy of bodies that stutter. Rather, they should be encountered as more of a kind of note towards stuttering, if you will. notes that attend to the ambiguity and the contradiction that I'm trying to work through contained within the concept and its broader usefulness and hopefully appeal. It could be suggested then that bodies that stutter and the processes of symbolic stuttering aligned to them may reach out towards other forms of desire and identity that struggle to resolve the relations between Lacan's real symbolic and imaginary registers, jouissance, and of course, the kind of tensions between identity and identification, and also a subject selfhood in an era when nearly all aspects of life are in some way socially mediated. On that then, I'd like to suggest, and I'd like to conclude my paper with the suggestion that, and I'm just kind of going to read off the slides, I've been told as well that I have to kind of conduct my own QA session, which is fine. So if there are any questions and answers at the end, I'm happy to kind of field them. So to just kind of conclude things, I'm suggesting here that bodies that stutter are bodies that are riven by the symbolic and they're located there. They are the bodies contained within representation, in this case celebrity and pornographic selfies, particularly the ones that you've seen are connected very clearly, aren't they? The kind of white, heteronormative, late capitalist masculinity that can only appear as bodies through processes of symbolic power, negotiation and also negation. As symbolic bodies, bodies that stutter do so because they are lodged between the bodies that matter in Judith Butler's work and bodies that mutter in the work of Tim Dean. To grasp this, they also need to be conceptualized through Lacan's real and symbolic and imaginary triad, and that a symbolic body that stutters comes to do so in response to the identity-led imaginary ego and imaginary other of the body that matters, and through the oblique forms of jouissance of the body that mutters in the real. Symbolic stuttering, therefore, is the process that occurs when bodies that stutter attempt to qualify and articulate their jouissance. Yet in the symbolic, this mode of expression falters, hesitates, and disfluently utters desire because it's always expressed incompletely or indeed enigmatically. In this way, I argue, symbolic stuttering may be a form of jouissance that can be partially expressed but never fully realised. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, because Danny's left and because Lily's left, I'm told that I have to kind of field some questions. Does anyone have any questions or points in relation to, as I was delivering that, you know, fairly dense, theoretical, in some places, paper. Alison.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, this is, I'm just kind of thinking aloud here. Firstly, thank you very much indeed for that incredibly rich and very thorough and rigorous and very scholarly paper. There was a lot of information there. So you're going to have to bear with me. Some of this may not be as thought through as I might wish, but Lacan famously said that masculine display is inherently feminine for some reason. And what Lacan said was that masculine and or virile display always somehow feminizes the subject. So, in a sense, it's possibly inevitable that representations of masculinity will inevitably be non-heteronormative, will inevitably be kind of queer in some way. So, if you're going to suggest that bodies can stutter, that there is something, and stuttering is, as you can see here, it's an attempt, but an ultimate failure to articulate something. To what extent would you say that bodies that stutter, the bodies that attempt to represent something, to what extent are bodies that stutter male or masculine bodies? And there is a difference between maleness and masculinity. So to what extent are bodies that stutter male or masculine bodies? Is stuttering an inherently queer unconscious practice or process? Or is it possible for female or feminine bodies to stutter also?
I think, again, it's a really good point. Thank you. And again, a lot of what you've just suggested there when you were speaking, Alison, it reminds me in many ways of the kind of position that Lacan takes, particularly in relation to the position of the feminine in Seminar 20, where he talks about the kind of the feminized position, which is a subjective position, not necessarily a kind of a mattering position, a body, in that respect. So this term body, the body that stutters, that kind of term body almost kind of from the outset fails us in some ways. And these masculine bodies that again you've seen here visually, I think you've hit onto something really interesting there, and it certainly informs my thinking, are simultaneously occupying somehow a kind of feminized or feminine subject position. Yeah? It's difficult to see that, and it's difficult if you don't drill into the kind of Lacanian stuff to understand what one might mean by that, in that the bodies are so visibly masculine. They're so visibly kind of muscular and phallic and all of that, that if I was to say, you know, well, these are feminine bodies or they're feminized bodies, I would think that, and that goes back to a kind of, and it's very much in Dean's work, a position, a kind of subject position. It's almost like going back to some of that earlier queer theoretical work as well, around this idea that queer is kind of more problematic to apply, for instance, to a body, a queer body, than it is to a queer position. Yeah, this kind of idea that we're all, or all have the potential, if you like, to be subjectively queer. We don't necessarily have to appear, whatever that might be, to be queer in the kind of material sense or the mattering sense. So that stuttering, and this is something which I'm working through, I'm very, very hesitant to claim or to state claims and say, yes, bodies that stutter are white, heterosexual, masculine bodies. They're not. You know, I think it's more to do with the body, and I perhaps should have made that clear, as a kind of a position rather than a body. So it might be, you know, that subjectivity stutter as much as bodies do. Does that kind of, yeah?
That makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense, kind of.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello. Does definitely. I mean, again, I've got to be careful here to kind of join in the club with all these kind of, you know, terms. Shattering, it also reminds me, Lee Edelman talks in Homographesis about narcissist schism. You know, this kind of idea that there's a kind of schism in the narcissist, you know, so it's quite complex. But Bassani as well, with this kind of concept, I think it feeds quite nicely into this idea of stuttering. So yeah, I would argue that they do, there's a tension there, but they're certainly feeding off of one another. Number one, so, and I think that a dialogue somehow, particularly between those kinds of theorists, Lee Edelman, Leah Bassani, Tim Dean, that kind of work which appeared in the late 1930s, early 2000s, it serves us quite well now as a kind of a way to re-engage with, particularly through these kinds of contexts, you know, discourses of social media, celebrity pornography, whatever. Alongside of that, I also think, and it's work I'm incredibly familiar with, and you know, I used to kind of fawn over Tim Dean when I was doing my PhD, and then I read No Limits, you know, the work which is connected to the discourse of barebacking. In that work, Dean barely mentions Lacan, barely mentions it, barely mentions the real, doesn't really kind of broach the psychoanalytic in relation to this discourse of, strictly speaking, gay men, you know, not using condoms to have sex, yeah? That's a very important thing, and I think Dean doesn't necessarily fail, but he fails to see the psychoanalytic potentials that might lie in an engaging of psychoanalysis, and for instance something like barebacking. This idea of no limits, this idea of transgression, this idea of, you know, bareback sex as an extreme form of jouissance. Yeah? Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that stuttering, as a concept, it feeds into some of the kind of language that I use. The hesitancy, the faltering. Dean talks a lot in, and Halberstam talks about it a lot, guilt. You know, this kind of discourse of guilt. David Halperin writes about gay shame. Particularly those kinds of discourse associated with barebacking, where there is this kind of discourse of extreme jouissance. But it's riven by also discourses of objection, disgust, shame. That kind of thing, certainly, I think, I'm talking just superficially here, but from the stuttering that might well inform, you know, that kind of hesitancy that comes through, let's face it, a fairly, you know, dangerous, extreme sexual practice. But again, a dangerous and extreme sexual practice that has been commodified and is incredibly popular, you know, in terms of, I mean, if you look at the films of someone like Liam Cole, who's a gay porn producer, right? Or you look at, you know, there are websites, an American website, which is incredibly popular called Raw Fuck Club, yeah? These men are having unprotected sex, and it's riven, pornography is a cornerstone of capitalism, right? It's riven by that kind of, that discourse of desire, disgust, shame, danger, all of those things, and it becomes an incredibly powerful kind of form of jouissance, I think. You know, I'm just thinking out loud there, but yeah, it's really interesting. And that would be the nice thing, eventually, to kind of think about this idea of stuttering and think about how, you know, you can't just lift and shift stuttering, you know, but somehow, if it could be applied to those other areas. Danny, who's now left, Danny and I were talking about trans identity and the kind of discourse of trans identity and how that might relate to some of the stuff around stuttering that I'm interested in. Hi.
Hey.
I think the celebrity context for me, I teach celebrity culture, so I publish less around issues in celebrity, but I teach it a lot. I teach an undergraduate module at Newcastle around discourses of celebrity, and it struck me that the predominance of celebrity and the kind of implicitness, particularly in kind of consumer-led societies such as this one, seem to kind of proliferate an incredibly powerful discourse of desire in capitalism, where if a celebrity endorses something, if a celebrity kind of tells us that this is the right thing to be doing, whatever, we don't necessarily become obedient to it, but we associate it a lot of the time with that, not necessarily just jouissance, which is a very psychoanalytic term, but desire. Celebrity and desire are kind of connected for me, really closely, and celebrity seems to also feed into this kind of idea, and it's then connected to jouissance, that desire is always an anxiety, you know? So if I look at, you know, Dan Osborne's body, I'm like, oh my goodness, my body's not like that. But it's a sexy body. Desire and anxiety, right? So they're kind of connected together in a kind of dyad. They're working together in a really complex way. And for me, I mean, and again, I'm not claiming this, but for me, celebrity culture certainly seems to be one of the most obvious, powerful, pertinent visual and cultural contexts that we have, you know, particularly in contemporary society. One only needs to look at the discourse of Trump and the discourse of celebrity associated with Trump to kind of understand that. Like, you know, we get the arenas of things which were potentially once a bit more separate, politics here, celebrity there, intersecting. And that's nothing necessarily new. If you look at Reagan, for instance, you know, it's just an example. But celebrity for me just seems like a very, very pertinent, almost invisibilized feature of particularly who we are and what we do, particularly in societies like this one, whether that's on social media or whether that's through more conventional discourses of media. We are, I would argue, you know, most of us might well have a Facebook profile or use Twitter. We kind of celebrify ourselves, you know? Do you know what I mean? I kind of put a really nice picture of myself as my profile picture. I don't, you know, so it's that kind of discourse of, well, actually, I'm celebrifying myself. I want the world to see my kind of ego. I want the world to see how great I look and what I'm doing and what I'm capable of and you know, self-promotion. So for me, it's kind of embedded in particularly kind of more contemporary discourses of culture and politics. I hope that answers your question. It's a bit roundabout, but... yeah. Hi.
Hi, yeah, that kind of relates to that. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the, you know, the social media aspect of it, if you are also kind of thinking about theorizing the responses to, you know, to these photos or selfies talked about,
yeah,
in terms of, you know, I would say that a lot on social media partly also beyond the discursive, insofar what you do on social media, you know, you upload a photo and then someone else likes it, or you share it, or, you know, and there are many kind of practices that also are, you know, beyond the discursive, and I wonder if that relates to what you've been talking about, or to what extent the very portrayal of these photos depends on the other, on an imagined other,
yeah,
on social media, in order to, you know, give some kind of response, or is it recognition to the person who has uploaded that particular photo?
That's really interesting. I think it kind of relates to just what you said there about an imaginary other. It's almost like saying that on social media, or prior to social media, so before social media, that kind of representation of an imaginary other through the discourse of the selfie was not necessarily impossible, but it just wasn't around, it wasn't seen in that way. I'm not suggesting here that social media is the big symbolic other, right? But social media, the discourse of Instagram, the discourse of Facebook, the discourse of Twitter, whatever, those are the kind of vessels. And these are capitalist forms, right? These are big, multinational, conglomerate, international businesses, right? But they allow the imaginary other to proliferate this kind of discourse of self-representation, self-worth, you know, self-surveillance, whatever you want to call it. So I think there's a tension there between the ways in which, you know, we as kind of users who see ourselves as individuals, it's riven through the kind of politics of identity and the kind of rise of identity politics, isn't it? And this kind of idea that the rise of the individual, I am this, I am that, I say this, I say that, the encouragement that we have in capitalism to do that, and the encouragement in capitalism that we also have to always kind of discern, to subscribe, to customise, to choose. And it's all right. So I walk into Starbucks and I want my coffee like this, and I want, you know, that kind of thing. I go on Netflix and I want that. I want to be able to fast forward it because, you know, all of those things which we do want to, we take for granted now, all of those kind of come from a symbolic place, but they absorb us as imaginary subjects. The other bit of that which is trickier, I think, is the kind of real. Someone like Dean would argue, or those theorists that work more with the Lacanian real would argue that actually, okay, the symbolic and the imaginary are kind of givens here. This is quite obvious, actually. The real is the kind of non-relation, you know? It's almost a kind of a post-structural question. You know, this kind of, it's like Derrida, you know, there's nothing beyond the text. This is just a text, you know? And for me, that's why, to go back to your question as well, celebrity is kind of fascinating, and also pornography, because they are, again, speaking just kind of broadly, they're not always textual, but 99.9% of the time they are. You know, the celebrity is not going to fall in love with you. You might fall in love with the celebrity. The pornographic scene is not going to kind of say to you, come on, join in, or, you know, that kind of thing. It's not going to buy you a drink, you know. No, not yet. But it's that kind of thing. It's not, it's kind of non-reciprocal. So it's this kind of non-relation, which for those psychoanalytic thinkers who think through the real, is perhaps more interesting. I haven't been as bold as, you know, bold enough to kind of go there yet, but certainly, I think that social media, because it offers up the illusion somehow of self-control. We seem to have agency, you know, this is my profile, these are my photographs, this is my kind of, you know, I'm going to bar these people from it, blah, 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 all of that. You seem to have agency, but again, that agency is on the one hand, in the one breath, yes, it's yours, but in the other, it's somebody else's. It's a big other's, you know, and it's a kind of real. So yeah. This guy, yeah.
I try to formulate what I want to say, it's a bit more complicated, but you talk a little about discourse, how it shapes the sexual desire. Mm. And then, okay, what I'm thinking a lot about is, for example, a concept like pop culture industry, Adorno Horkheim and what Roger Behrens made out of it, that that it's necessary to participate. Because, for example, I live in Berlin, usually, and all my friends work in media. So they really sitting on a table, eating something, and they make a photo because they have to, because the manager said, do it.
Yeah.
Do one photo a day.
Yeah.
And also what they do is shaped by what the people like. So if they get not only a few likes, so there is a way of reciprocity.
I suppose, yeah.
And through this whole consuming, and it's just, it's a bit vague, but you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, yeah. I mean, if you use it vis-a-vis the kind of Frankfurt School thing, Adorno Horkheimer, it's this kind of enlightenment as mass deception model. This kind of idea that we are kind of deceiving each other, but deceiving ourselves. And from what you've just said there, this kind of veers and steers the argument slightly away from psychoanalysis. But if one looks at, you know, you're talking about popular culture, if one looks at, for instance, the kind of the legacy, if you like, of postmodernity and those thinkers that might be understood or regarded as postmodern thinkers, I'm thinking of Jean Baudrillard, for instance, this kind of hyperreal, you know, this idea that Baudrillard's hyperreal indicates to us that representation precedes reality. It comes before reality. So the representation, not literally, but conceptually, sometimes literally, but the representation is more important than the experience, yeah? So I can't just go into a restaurant and eat my food and have a conversation. I have to take a photograph of it and I have to post it to Facebook to... It's a kind of anxiety and a desire at the same time as well to gratify, but also to kind of be included in this kind of capitalist, consumerist model that I can't move outside of it. It's almost impossible to.
But isn't that exactly the promises which can never fulfill in the culture industry? Because this is what I thought about.
Mm.
Because when I'm looking at those pictures, then I have a feeling, okay, I will never look like this because I don't have the time to do that much sports. probably, and actually, I don't want it. And so there is the promise you can be like this,
of course.
you can have all that.
Yeah.
And so you run after this promise and work harder. And so your whole, also psychological elements are formed by this whole thing around us.
Yeah. I agree with you 100%. You know that these promises, which are kind of coming from the symbolic, but then they're incorporated into the imaginary and they're interpolated through the real, so through media. I mean, you just have to look at the whole discourse of, for instance, I don't know, the celebrity diet, for instance, yeah? That kind of thing, it offers you a promise, but the promise is always kind of subscribed through, written through. It's very classifiable as well. You know, we seem to love, in late capitalism and kind of neoliberalism, kind of rate ourselves. So yeah, I ran this far today and, you know, my iPhone mapped it for me and, you know, I eat this many carbs, I eat this many calories, you know, I've been to the gym this many times. That whole promise becomes for some, and I think actually it's fairly emblematic when you look at the kind of discourse, particularly of, it's a very UK, well it's not a UK thing, it's a UK-US thing. John Mercer with IB Taurus has got a really good book coming out called Gay Pornography, and he talks about this in the book, John. He talks about the kind of intersections, so, you know, I'm a gay porn star, I'm not a gay porn star, but you know, if I were a gay porn star. Gay porn stars are also kind of personal trainers as well. So the kind of discourse of the personal trainer kind of fits with the kind of the escort / gay porn star. And the gay porn star is not a gay porn star at all because he's gay for pay, he's actually straight. So it becomes this very complex kind of landscape of identity and identification, but within which there is this kind of promise of a kind of an ideal, an ego ideal, the kinds of images that you've seen there. For some men like this, this is a very, very absorbing, sexy, powerful world. You know, it's emblematic of something which I think is very kind of 21st century and very capitalist and very kind of neoliberal. And for me, again, it goes back to your point, it seems to be, I actually have a journal article which came out a couple of years ago called From Reality to Fantasy, which talks about this. I talk about a kind of triangulation between the intersections of the kind of porn star, the reality TV star, and the kind of the management of self-representation and what that means, you know? And how we often find that through these kinds of discourses of self-representation, that the micro-celebrity or the celebrity are involved in various kinds of activities, you know, body management, slash porn, slash reality TV, that kind of thing. And maybe it doesn't answer your question, but it maybe just kind of summarises what you're getting at. But I think it's a huge feature of contemporary society that this bodily anxiety, which has been there for decades, has been amplified. And particularly, I mean, you just have to look at Instagram, you know, and look at the ways in which the body on Instagram becomes, you know, we have terms for it now, Insta-famous. And there are entire Instagram blogs, you know, which obsess over kind of women's thighs and men's six-packs and, you know, the muscularity of the body. It's a very problematic, yet simultaneously very interesting kind of landscape. Yeah? Thank you. Okay, it's, wow, 8:05, that's good. If everyone's done, we'll call that a day. Thank you again.